supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. A pair of government watchdog groups in Philadelphia hopes to bar the city commissioners from overseeing May's primary election. As WHYY's Aaron Mozell reports, they filed suit as part of an ongoing effort to abolish the century-plus-old office.
Every 4 years, voters elect three city commissioners to oversee elections in Philadelphia. Under state law, a judge must order them to step aside if they're running for re-election because it would be a conflict of interest. But it's not the only time that should happen, says Allison Perlman, executive director of Philadelphia 3.0, a political action committee.
We filed the suit with the Supreme Court this month because there is a charter change question that triggers this provision on the ballot in May.
The ballot question centers on changing the bidding process for certain city contracts, contracts that could involve the city commissioner's office. The suit filed by Perlman's group and the Committee of 70 argues that Common Pleas Court President Judge Sheila Woods Skipper should temporarily replace the commissioners with three judges, or so-called electors. David Thornburg with Committee of 70 says this should happen a lot more. Since 2002, Thornburg says city commissioners should have been relieved from their election duties about 75% of the time.
It does raise the awkward question as to why these offices exist if every time we have a ballot amendment and every time they run for office, we keep paying them, but they don't have to come to work.
In May, Committee of 70 Philadelphia 3.0 and about a dozen other groups launched the Better Philadelphia Elections Committee. That panel wants to replace the city commissioners with a Department of Elections led by a director who would be appointed by the mayor. City Commissioner Lisa Dealey has said she thinks that's a bad idea.
They would be beholden to the appointer. Us as elected commissioners, we're beholden to the voters that elect us.
A spokesman for the Administrative Office of Pennsylvania Courts, which is representing Judge Woods Skipper, says the office doesn't comment on pending litigation. Deputy City Commissioner Fred Voigt said the office, which is not named as a defendant, would respond to the suit, quote, when it's appropriate. I'm Aaron Mozell, WHYY News.
Budget hearings are underway in Philadelphia City Council. Two big unanswered questions that have big dollar implications are dominating the discussion. Here's WHYY's Tom McDonald.
First to testify was Jane Slusser, the mayor's chief of staff. She says the city could have some serious issues depending on what's in or out of the federal budget.
The Trump administration's proposed budget cuts would be devastating to Philadelphia, with reductions in federal spending affecting a variety of areas, including low-income housing, emergency management, law enforcement, fire protection, public safety, health programming, and numerous other critical services.
Slusser says because of the city's sanctuary city status, the city could lose additional money from Washington and Harrisburg.
The threat of a possible reduction in funding from the Commonwealth remains as well through a variety of Senate and House bills that propose funding restrictions based on our and other counties following of the constitutional requirement that a criminal warrant be provided in order for us to detain individuals on behalf of the federal government.
Councilman Curtis Jones says he's concerned the city hasn't come up with any backup plans if these cuts become reality.
What concerns me most is that they're talking about retroactively taking grant money from us, which I don't know how do we take back expenditures that we've put out on the street.
The city also doesn't have a backup plan if the sweetened beverage tax is struck down in court. It's holding off work on libraries, recreation centers, and parks until the case is resolved, and that could endanger pre-K expansion planned for September. Councilman Bill Greenlee says he's concerned how to budget when money will be held in limbo, but doesn't think the budget itself is a hard sell.
There's always going to be questions about budget priorities. That's what the budget process is for. Without a tax increase proposal, I don't think the budget, as we're looking at it now, is going to be super problematic.
The budget has to be passed by the end of June, and a lot will likely change before then. I'm Tom McDonald, WHYY News.
Last September, the Pennsylvania Supreme Court ruled that a section of the state's gaming law is unconstitutional. The part of the law that came into question involves the local share tax. The the amount casinos owe to the communities where they're located. Keystone Crossroads' Lindsay Lazarski reports on what's at stake for communities that host casinos.
When playing the slots in Pennsylvania, casinos and gamblers aren't the only ones making money. The state collects 54 cents for every dollar a player loses in a slot machine. And while the state uses most of that money for property tax relief, some of it goes to the state's horse racing industry, as well as an economic development fund. And a small portion is set aside for communities with casinos, like Paradise Township.
Paradise Township is really like the name says, it's paradise.
Hiking up a trail built by the Mount Airy Casino, Peter Gons is one of the township supervisors. Paradise Township is a sleepy and bucolic town in the Pocono Mountains, where hiking trails, fishing streams, and the Mount Airy Casino are valuable amenities. Gon says it's a tricky balance having a casino in the community.
Mount Airy obviously brings in a tremendous amount of business and revenue for the township, but it comes at a cost.
Since the casino opened in 2007, there have been more visitors to Paradise. And that has meant more wear and tear on the township's 35 miles of winding, mountainous roads and bridges. The casino has been a boon for this town, once flush with mountain resorts, which have either shut down or are struggling. Here's Gons again.
Most important to us is maintaining our fair share. That was the commitment when the business came in, when Mount Airy came in.
And so Paradise Township counts on the casino money for more than half of its yearly budget. And now there's a risk. The township could get less in the future. That's because of a lawsuit filed by the Mount Airy Casino questioning the local share tax. Here's attorney Michael Sklar. He represents the casino.
We're not saying for a second that there shouldn't be a local share tax.
Sklar says Mount Airy has been a good neighbor to the community. The casino employs more than 1,100 people and is the largest taxpayer in the county. He says the casino just wants to be taxed fairly.
It just has to be done in a constitutional, responsible way.
Under the gaming law as it is now, most casinos, except the casino in Philadelphia and smaller boutique casinos, pay host communities whichever is greater, either $10 million or 2% of their total slot revenue. Most casinos have had to pay out the $10 million. So casinos that make less money in slots, like Mount Airy, end up paying more money to the local share tax. That's why Mount Airy filed the lawsuit. And in September, the state Supreme Court ruled in their favor. Now it's up to state lawmakers to fix the law. But the clock is ticking for communities that have been relying on the casino money.
Erie is a place that you can find almost anything that you can find in a lot of bigger cities, but just in a smaller scale.
In Erie County in northwestern Pennsylvania, County Executive Kathy Delkemper is concerned about the ruling.
We agreed to have a casino. Not every county did.
Erie County is home to Presque Isle Downs and counts on about $5.5 million from the casino. County officials have been using more than half of that money to pay down bond debt and $1 million to improve the library system.
The state needs to keep its promise and keep at whole so that we don't have to go after funding from our taxpayers when we were promised this casino money.
Delkemper is worried that lawmakers could really change how local share funds are distributed.
Well, what concerns me at this time is we're opening up legislation. Well, we have to have new legislation, and people have seen the success of the casinos and what they've done for the counties and the communities that have the casinos, and I think people want a piece of that.
Whether state lawmakers view casinos as cash cows is a question gaming industry observers like Robert Ambrose think about. He's an instructor at Drexel University and points out why some local leaders are concerned at the moment.
It's a matter of everyone in Harrisburg and beyond, I think, getting together and looking at the fair share. What is the fair share? If we can make most of the communities happy and everyone sees something from the pie, as it were, because you have to remember it's not just about gambling. It's about the entire hospitality infrastructure.
At the State House in Harrisburg, lawmakers agree that local communities should get a piece of the pie. But there's disagreement on how much casinos should pay. One idea is to increase the local share tax from 2% to 4% on total slot revenue, including Philadelphia's Sugar House Casino. Another idea, which also includes the Philly Casino, is to have a $10 million annual license renewal fee for slot machines. But that might not hold up with the court's ruling. Over the next few months, it's expected that lawmakers will continue debating the issue. They have until Memorial Day to fix the law. Lindsay Lazarski, Keystone Crossroads.
Good news for Chester County businessman Richard Ireland. His corruption case was dismissed yesterday by a federal judge. The Philadelphia Inquirer's Craig McCoy has been following the case, as well as larger implications for Pennsylvania's campaign finance laws. Craig, welcome back to Newsworks Tonight.
It's good to be here.
Safe to say this verdict was a surprise?
Yeah, I mean, certainly, as you know, the judge just tossed the case out before the defense had even presented its case. So, and that's pretty rare. I've rarely seen that, particularly in a high-profile case like this.
What bar needed to be set and what wasn't met?
Well, the judge accepted the defense mid-trial pleading, which argued that the evidence, even if construed favorably for the government, did not prove that Richard Ireland had conspired to bribe the state treasurer to get contracts.
State Treasurer Rob McCord, who was found guilty and, as part of his efforts to avoid a stronger sentence, had been wearing a wiretap recording his conversations with Mr. Ireland.
That's right. Rob McCord was trapped initially, in fact, by another Democratic figure that was caught by the FBI, a fellow named John Estey, who used to be Mayor Rendell's and Governor Rendell's top aide. Estey taped McCord, implicated McCord, and then McCord wore a wire briefly and also taped Dick Ireland, who was a Chester County businessman who made a fortune serving as a middleman between politicians and investment houses. Investment houses are banned from giving campaign contributions. The way it worked is Ireland gave the contributions and then shilled for these companies who would then be hired by a variety of public agencies.
I understand that prosecutors gratuitously described McCord as a lukewarm witness. Explain.
Yeah, it was very interesting. I mean, you know, McCord had pled guilty in an unrelated corruption case. He'd pled guilty to shaking down contributors in his bid for governor several years ago. Mind you, Ireland played no role whatsoever in that case. But, you know, he was the star witness for the prosecution, and he would not concede that he and Ireland had been up to no good and were engaged in an illegal business, and in fact basically kind of weakly said, well, now that I think about it, now that I've talked to the FBI and the prosecutors, I realize now that I was breaking the law, but I didn't realize it at the time.
Does this leave the state, though, in an open-for-business environment regarding campaign finance laws?
I think it does. I mean, what's troubling about this is, you know, there was little doubt that Ireland had given hundreds of thousands of dollars in campaign contributions over the years. In fact, strikingly, one of the government exhibits was his own worksheet in which he listed campaign contributions on a balance sheet along with regular expenses, including overhead and taxes. And he, in return, won millions and millions of dollars for his clients. Where the government overreached here, or what was bold about what they attempted to do here, is they said that the campaign contributions themselves were the bribes, as opposed to your classic bribe of a direct payment in cash to someone for their personal use. And that's where they got slapped back by the judge, who basically said, you know, campaign contributions have been the lifeblood of politics, the mother's milk of politics, for 300 years in this country. You've not crossed the line to argue that they were really bribes.
Does yesterday's finding change the sentencing timeline for former State Treasurer McCord?
Yeah, I mean, no date has been set for his sentencing, and we don't know whether, as a result of his wearing a wire, there might be other cases where he would be a witness. But at the moment, at least, depending on how vengeful the prosecutors are, you do wonder whether, because of his lukewarm testimony, whether they'll back off in his own sentence, in his own case.
What's the maximum potential sentence for McCord?
I think that under the guidelines, as opposed to the maximum sentence, the guidelines call for 8 years in prison.
But again, that's subject to interpretation at this point.
Right. We don't know what's going to happen, but I mean, if I'm McCord, I'd be very nervous.
Well, Craig, you keep cool. We'll talk to you again as the case proceeds.
Okay. Thanks again.
Philadelphia Inquirer's Craig McCoy on Newsworks Tonight. Seven Democrats and one Republican are vying to serve as Philadelphia's next district attorney. The only African-American in the field is Democrat Tariq Al-Shabazz. He spent 5 years as an assistant district attorney in Philadelphia, another 20 in private practice. The Brooklyn native converted to Islam at the age of 13. Al-Shabazz spoke with WHYY senior reporter Dave Davies.
Well, Tariq Al-Shabazz, welcome to Newsworks Tonight. When you made your announcement, I wasn't there, but I read that you called yourself the perfect candidate for DA. True?
That is true.
And in what way?
Well, because I come with a certain level of experience. I've been 30 years into criminal work. In 30 years, I've practiced as a assistant district attorney, as the first assistant district attorney, and for 2 decades as a criminal defense attorney. My experience in the community in which I grew up, in the community that I engender myself to, coaching football or doing otherwise, gives me, I think, the well-rounded view of how to fix this office.
A lot of the candidates in this race say that this district attorney's office needs fundamental change, that it's been on the wrong track for a long time. Do you agree?
There are programs in it that work, but they need to be improved, and there are programs in there that don't work that need to be scrapped. I am not one of those that say you blow it up. No, you don't blow it up. If you blow it up, what are you replacing it with? But I am one that says that there has to be common sense reform by someone with the experience to reform.
Okay, let's be very specific. What's a change that needs to be made? How will you make it?
Well, there's a couple of things. The first and foremost, most important change is diversity. There has to be a change in the hiring practice and the recruitment. There is a lack of African-Americans, Hispanic, Asian, non-white individuals in the office. And what they bring, this diversity, is a diverse understanding and a diverse trust with the community.
We've had an African-American DA for 8 years. But that wasn't accomplished when he was there?
It wasn't accomplished because I think that the recruiting practices were abysmal. I thought that the hiring practices weren't good, and the hiring committee, not everyone, but some of the people that are involved in the hiring committee were looking for people like them as opposed to looking for people that would be good for the office.
Okay, so more diversity. What else would you do?
I would also include diversion programs. There are a lot there. There are some that are working good, but there are some that need to be adjusted.
And when we say diversion, we're talking about people arrested for nonviolent crimes.
Nonviolent offenses, some theft offenses, some drug offenses.
Sent to treatment and community programs rather than jail.
Rather than prison. However, under the diversion programs currently, they are arrested. And when they're arrested, they go through the process. And if they complete the diversion program, that arrest can be expunged, but it's still an arrest. What I suspect and what I believe will be more beneficial is rather than having someone with a scarlet letter, catch them before that.
The scarlet letter, the stigma of a felony
conviction. The stigma of
the
arrest of a felony conviction or even an arrest that's expunged. I challenge people when they say it's expunged, it's expunged. That just simply means that they're not supposed to look at it. It doesn't mean that they don't look at it. So I say you have diversionary programs and they'd be very specific in terms of specific crimes, but that it allows people to actually go through the process prior to the arrest. And if they complete it, then it's good.
You have some tax debts that have come up in the campaign. It's been reported you have tax liens of $137,000 to the IRS, so about $50,000 to city, $2,500 to the state. Those numbers about right?
No, the numbers absolutely aren't right. The IRS, for example, I've grown up in Brooklyn, but I've lived in Philadelphia for approximately 30 years. For 2 decades, I had a business, small business. I have an
As an attorney.
I had an accountant who prepared my taxes. And I might add that all of my taxes, any income I received, I reported. And I didn't ever try to hide it or try to lean. And then I get audited or my taxes get looked at and the IRS say that, no, we're not going to take those deductions. You owe this money. We begin to have a dispute, the IRS and myself, and I'm a hell of a lawyer, but I haven't beat the IRS yet. And so penalties and interest begin to accrue. All of those things happen. Mind you, I pay my taxes, but I'm disputing these.
Okay.
With regard to city, the amount that's being stated are in litigation and dispute, and that's why they're there. And so they will be in litigation and dispute, and until I'm able to actually resolve that, then that appears the way it is.
You have a distinctive look. You have a full beard. The lower half is bright red. People must ask you about it. Is it it's of religious significance, is it?
There is religious significance, but there's cultural significance as well. I think that there are other cultures that, in fact, use henna to dye their beard or the henna on their hands to put tattoos. It's to that degree. The red that people talk about, that's gray. That's actually gray hair.
It was gray.
And the only reason the lower half is red is because the other part isn't gray yet. Because okay. What henna does is it only attaches to the gray. So anyone knows about that vegetable material would know that, no, this is somebody who has gray hair. But I anticipate going through this campaign, it all may be red soon.
Okay.
Because it may all be gray.
Tariq El-Shabazz, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you for having me today.
Philadelphia District Attorney candidate Tariq El-Shabazz speaking with WHYY senior reporter Dave Davies. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yaakov, Kimberly Haas, Ty Johnson, and Brett Rader. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for NewsWorks Tonight.